Hey, it's Scarp. I've been blessed to have an incredible career in journalism, politics, and media. Along the way, I've made a lot of friends and a few frenemies. So we thought, why not turn on the mics and see what happens? Welcome to Season 2 of Scarp and Friends. I'm living my best life. Blake, is it the off year? Because it sure doesn't feel like it. It feels like we just went from the election ending to we're right back in the middle of it. We've had so much activity already. It's February still. We've got, it was about a month after the election that Donald Trump was out here. He endorsed Karen Robeson for governor. She recently announced she's running. Congressman Andy Biggs is running. It sure seems like Katie Hobbs is running because she has been...
veto machine.
has she? I don't know that she's vetoed a lot yet this year. I guess she did veto the election bill.
Her pen's warming up. Stamp, yeah.
So it's like we're already in 2026. I mean, I remember Governor Ducey, our old boss, he announced... When he ran for governor in 2014, he announced in February, I think it was, of 2014 with an August 2014 primary. I just don't know that you can do that anymore. It feels like you got to get started really early.
Well, Carrie Lake, remember, well, actually, I guess Karen and Carrie Lake both announced the summer before the year. But yeah, it wasn't even Christmas, and Donald Trump is endorsing Karen Taylor Robeson for governor. So she's... You know, soon after that, she's in. Biggs it somehow announced before that she did early this year as well, and I guess we're already off.
Well, you know, I think Democrats are betting that the environment's going to look a lot different in 2026. And after the 24 election, I mean, I think I may have said it here on this podcast, that the environment can change quickly. I mean, Scott Brown winning Massachusetts, we were just talking about this. That was, he won Ted Kennedy's U.S. Senate seat in Massachusetts. That was just less than a year after Barack, I think it was 10 months after Barack Obama was elected president in this landslide election. So things can change quickly. I'm not there yet, though. I mean, some of the polling has been all over the place on some of the things happening federally. But my sense is, while the left has gotten somewhat, you know, they've kind of come out of their post-election mourning and are getting more organized, we're starting to see protests and stuff, I think Republicans are still as energized. And that, to me, is the difference. It was in 2010, you had the Tea Party, and the Democrats were kind of demoralized in some ways, but this feels like both sides are energized. I think on DOGE and the efforts happening at the federal level, you know, I believe the polling that shows that people are inclined to want to root out the waste. They may not like all of the messaging, but I think they appreciate that there's finally a focus on this. And President Trump, you know, it doesn't have to run for re-election. So, you know, he can do a lot of the things that Republicans have been talking about doing for 40 plus years. And so I think there's energy and enthusiasm about that. So I think there's still a lot of unknowns, I guess I would say, about 2026 and what the environment will look like.
Right. Well, and I saw something recently where somebody asked if Trump was going to endorse J.D. Vance, and he kind of, like, shrugged it off. And then when I was reading some analysis about it, it was in large part because the second he endorses somebody, J.D. Vance or otherwise, he's now a lame duck. So I think that was a big reason why he didn't do it, because, you know, if he endorses somebody before 2026, it becomes almost like looking at like, oh, what are we going to vote on that person? Is that going to be 2028 or are we going to actually focus on the last 2 years?
Now I think you've been preaching the J.D. Vance songbook for some time now. I know you've been a big fan. I didn't know that much about him other than Hillbilly Elegy and seeing the movie. I didn't read the book, but I've been really impressed by him. I really like what he's doing. He's such a great messenger. He just steamrolls these Sunday show talk show hosts. And he's, you know, it's kind of interesting to have a vice president who's like on Twitter, you know, or X, you know, pushing back on people. So to me, he's been somebody who kind of came out of nowhere and has proven to be, I think, a really effective voice for the party.
Yeah, I was a little vindicated when that vice president debate happened because everybody was like, he's awful, he's not doing the great job. And then when he had, because I've heard him speak, I mean, I listened to the book on audiobook, so it felt like I had a one-on-one relationship with him because I listened to him. And then when I saw him at the debate, I was like, yes, this is who I always thought J.D. Vance could be, was the guy that makes MAGA reasonable to the masses.
The Democrats, I think, are struggling, and our party faced the same thing, I would say, after, you know, 08, after 2012, of who is the face and voice of the Democratic Party. And there really isn't anyone, and you see these kind of, you know, sparsely attended weird press conferences, like they had one, Chuck Schumer had one in front of the FBI building, and it was just kind of like a laughable photo. So I think they're struggling with who is the face and voice. Is it AOC? Is it Chuck Schumer? Hakeem Jeffries has kind of, I think, fallen flat in some of these interviews and stuff. Kamala Harris is, you know, signed with some Hollywood agency to go make money. The Obamas are nowhere to be seen. So I think they're struggling with who is the voice? What's the direction? They haven't figured that out. There's still time, but that hasn't come together for them.
I would look out for Jared Polis. I still think, I mean, even though he's not, to me, whenever there's like national, like not a person who's in the spotlight at the national level, that's when you start looking at the states, because, you know, Politico and all them aren't focused on each individual state. And, you know, Polis, while I feel like Colorado's seen better days, he's still really well liked out there. And he's,
yeah, but is he not woke again, woke enough for the party?
Well, and that's the big question. I think also listening to James Carville, because James Carville has, to me, been the loudest.
He's been very critical.
Yeah, especially with, like, you know, the David Hogg appointment, whatever it is, to the DNC. He's officially been sounding the alarm for the Democrat Party, and I wouldn't be surprised if he's off hunting for the next big Democrat person.
But did you hear what Mayor Pete had to say the other day? Mayor Pete came out and basically criticized all these DEI programs and said that they're what create Trump voters.
What do we mean when we talk about diversity? Is it caring for people's different experiences and making sure no one's mistreated because of them, which I will always fight for? Or is it making people sit through a training that looks like something out of Portlandia, which I have also experienced, and it is how Trump Republicans are made, if that comes to your workplace with the best of intentions, but doesn't actually get at what actually matters here, what's actually at stake.
Got a lot of pushback from the left on this, but, you know, it tells me that there's at least an attempt within the Democratic Party to have some self-examination. I'm just not sure if kind of the hardcore base will allow it based on some of the reaction.
They definitely won't allow it, but I think after a certain point, it kind of should. I mean, look how long it's taken for Trump to even cement kind of his personality in the Republican Party. I mean, the amount of quote-unquote never-Trumpers in 2016 to now are very small. They still exist, but, you know, it is Trump's party now, and the Republican Party has moved in that direction.
Yeah. Well, there'll be plenty of time to figure it out, but the bottom line is, like it or not, 2026 is here. Do you like winning? Well, at Winged Victory Agency, so do we. Our team is experts at strategic messaging, crisis communications, running large-scale campaigns, and really just solving problems. We won every campaign we were involved in the 2024 cycle. And our clients include businesses, CEOs, elected officials, think tanks, and major organizations all over the country. From PR to messaging, media training, and managing teams around a strategy, think of us as your easy button. Go to Winged Victory Agency to learn more or shoot me an email at scarp@wingedvictory.agency. And thanks for listening. Well, I love living in Arizona. I think everybody knows that. We just have a really exceptional quality of life. And in the Phoenix metro area, which is really a massive city now, we've largely escaped the complicated problems of some other big cities, Seattle, Denver, San Francisco, even places like Houston. But there's one issue that has reared its head recently in Arizona, and that's homelessness. And we see it more and more. We see it in our neighborhoods, businesses, and not just in the city core. It's also creeped into the suburbs and the exurbs. And the data backs it up. According to the nonpartisan Common Sense Institute, which we're a big fan of here on the show, Arizona has actually seen a 40% increase in our homeless population in just the past 5 years. We've invested over $1 billion we've pumped into this problem. The zone in downtown Phoenix became really a national symbol of what has become a humanitarian and public safety crisis. So everyone's trying to figure out what can be done to address this problem and how can Arizona maybe take the lead. And joining us today is Devin Kurtz, who is the Public Safety Policy Director for the Cicero Institute, another think tank that we're a big fan of here on the show. The Cicero Institute does great work all over the country. Devin, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Devin's visiting from Salt Lake City. And for those who aren't that familiar, Devin, with the Cicero Institute, tell us a little bit about what you all do.
Sure. So the Cicero Institute was founded about 6 years ago in San Francisco. Oddly enough, you mentioned the city is one that's particularly challenged on this issue of homelessness and public safety. And we were really born out of that. We had no intention of working on the issue. You know, I came on to work on prisons. I had a colleague, Judge Glock, who's now at Manhattan Institute, who was working on housing policy. But we couldn't deny what was happening around us. And our work on homelessness, which is, I would say, leading a lot of the country in a new direction, is born out of our experience there. If we saw how bad things got, no one has spent more money, other than maybe Los Angeles, than San Francisco on homelessness, and yet the outcomes are worse than ever.
So is what Arizona is seeing, is this a problem that's unique to us, or are we seeing this across the country?
It's particularly acute here. What I would say is that when we talk about homelessness, we have to really parse that out into subpopulations. Mm-hmm. What are we talking about? And when we think about homelessness, I think most of us like to think of, you know, a family that's down on their luck, that ends up at a soup kitchen where hopefully our family maybe volunteers on a Thanksgiving or something.
Right.
But that's not what we see when we walk outside. Certainly when I lived in San Francisco, that was not what I was seeing. And now that I'm in Salt Lake, it's the same thing. It's mostly men. It's mostly middle-aged men. Many of them seem to have visible distress, whether that's from mental illness or substance abuse. And what I like to point to is, you know, in 2013, Arizona had about a third of its homeless population living on the street. So 70% or so were in shelters. Mm. People who are in shelters tend to cycle through homelessness fairly quickly. Within a month, 45 days, 2 months, they've found some way to get back on their feet, whether that's through a government program or not, they're cycling much faster. With the unsheltered population, it's much slower. These people are facing much more acute problems. Now, fast forward to today, The most recent count for Arizona is about half of its homeless population is in that category. So we're not just seeing an increase overall in homelessness, but a massive shift in the acuity. So more people are struggling with a greater array of challenges than 10 years ago, and the services have gotten worse in terms of addressing those underlying issues.
And what are some of those underlying issues?
Sure. I mean, the biggest ones are substance abuse. It's undeniable. And yet, people try to deny it. So University of California at San Francisco, a great institution, did the largest study on homelessness in the country about 2 years ago. And what it found was, you know, the whole document is saying, oh, it's housing costs, it's economic issues, there's all of these drivers. If we just had one more welfare subsidy for people struggling from homelessness, we could solve this issue. But you dig into it, and 45 pages in, you find that only 7% of homeless people in California, the most expensive state in the country, said that housing costs were the reason that they were homeless. Instead, two-thirds of them cited drug addiction, having, you know, these were not people who were, you know, smoking pot. They were addicted to methamphetamine, doing heroin, et cetera. But 80% of them had mental illness of some variety, ranging from you know, something relatively minor to full-blown schizophrenia. So it's far more complicated than the talking points you'll often hear from activists, which is, oh, these greedy developers, you know, they're not doing enough to build low-income housing. Well, it couldn't be further from the truth. We have more subsidized housing than ever before. Mm. In Arizona alone, they've more than doubled the supply of subsidized housing specifically for the homeless. And yet, as they made that housing less supportive in terms of resources for those with mental illness and substance abuse, as they've lifted requirements for those individuals to participate in treatment, stay sober, you know, try to get jobs, et cetera, we've seen the outcomes get much worse and the population balloon.
But the argument of the so-called housing first policy is, okay, if you get somebody into a house under a roof, then you can address all of these other issues. But you're saying that that's not how we've structured the system, because there is no requirements or incentives for behavioral change and no services to support Correct. That.
I think that there's a tendency by advocates and activists to switch between the different subpopulations of homelessness to build their argument. Mm-hmm. So they will give you this picture of the mom who's down on her luck, who maybe enjoys a joint every now and then, and say, well, if you require her to be sober, she's going to lose her housing and not be able to provide for her family, and maybe she doesn't need drug treatment, maybe she just needs to be left alone. But in my past, I've worked with men who are coming out of prison in a transitional housing program up in Vermont, and what we saw was that these men needed a guiding hand. These were dysfunctional people. That's how they got to prison, and without the structure of our program, which did give them housing, but as a condition of housing, they had to enroll in a program. So they didn't actually get a lease. And this is the big difference between housing first and what's called transitional housing. Is in transitional housing, you don't get a lease. You get a program plan, an agreement, and as a condition of that, you will make meaningful progress towards getting a job. You will stay sober. You will, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Now, it wasn't that if someone broke the contract, we immediately threw them out and sent them back to jail, but that was always the threat. We were in close conversation with probation officers, with parole officers, and if people started to slip up, we knew, law enforcement knew, the community knew. That's a model that can work for people who are quite dysfunctional. The Housing First model says, oh, well, here's a housing subsidy, here's a lease. We're going to enroll you in disability so that you can pay for that portion of it that you have to fund yourself. And we're just going to leave you alone and hope for the best. And when the Urban Institute did a randomized control trial of this in Denver with people who were coming out of prison, they, again, just like the UCSF report, smashing success for Housing First, except for the people who died. Mm. And in fact, the people who received the Housing First intervention had a 50% higher death rate than the ones who received the transitional housing support. So sure, some of them stayed housed, but when there's a death rate that's that high, I start to get concerned. And we've actually seen more of these really robust trials that have actually delayed in their publication, in part because they don't really know how to explain away this spike in deaths. That when I look at that and I see the population they're working with, I'm like, oh, these are drug overdoses. These are people who are in states of psychosis who can't care for themselves. You've given them a lease and nothing else.
So I think this used to be viewed largely as something that was left to municipal government to, you know, provide shelters and deal with it. But at least here, I don't know what you're seeing in other states. This has, I think, risen to a statewide concern.
Yes.
And, you know, frankly, it's something that I just don't think we talked about 10 years ago or maybe even 6 years ago. You've started to see it creep into public opinion polling when people are asked what are some of the top issues that they're concerned about. This is one of them. So what are things that can be done? You know, I think a lot of people hear that billion-dollar figure, $1 billion invested. And at least my reaction is, you know what, if $1 billion could be invested and solve this problem, I'd be all for it. I'd be for $2 billion.
Mm-hmm.
But no one really knows where that money's going, what it's being spent on. It clearly hasn't been effective because the population is just growing. Where are you seeing, is there any glimmers of hope where someone is doing something that's working that could be applied here?
Sure. There's a couple of things I want to touch on. And the first is here in Arizona, and that's legislative audit that was done on the Department of Housing that was really illuminating a few months ago that showed that some of the grant money that had gone out to a lot of these homeless service organizations, a lot of the housing organizations, they had been using it to give, not all of it by any means, but a portion of it, to give four-figure personal loans to their executives. I mean, just classic mismanagement of funds,
mm-hmm.
things that you can't easily explain away.
Yeah.
And so there's that basic thing of where when you don't follow the money, when you have no one looking over it and everyone's just believing the best intentions, even good people, well-intentioned people who want to help homeless people end up being caught up in a mismanagement of the system. So I think there's that piece of it, that a lot of the reason why throwing money at the problem hasn't worked, as with anything that happens with government when they try to do that, you end up creating perverse incentives. You end up allowing people to have to fund projects that have no connection to the real needs of the population that they're serving. So there's that piece of it. And then you have the federal government's approach, which has been about $6 billion a year going out into the states without the states being at the table. So the federal government has assumed that homelessness in every part of the country is exactly the same,
mm-hmm.
deserves the exact same solution. And they have these nonprofits that are operating in the states that are responding to their $6 billion annually in incentives to do what they say. And municipalities have a little bit more of a seat at the table with some of those conversations, but states have largely been kept out. And that's what we started to see in the last couple of years is states like Arizona, states like Florida, Georgia, Texas, Utah, say, well, hold up a minute. You know, what are we using these funds for? Where are the gaps? So if the federal government is taking one approach, should the state take the same approach? Or maybe it should look at the needs of its population and diversify how it's using some of those funds. So Florida and Georgia are two great examples of doing that. They've reallocated their state funds that were going towards homelessness away from the federal response, Housing First, and towards that transitional housing model I mentioned earlier, where you're trying to create an environment for someone who's in recovery, whether that's from a mental illness or from substance abuse, where they can get back on their feet. They're taking that approach. A lot of other states are interested in following suit. It's challenging because of how much money the federal government has spent. Most states don't spend much money at all.
Yeah.
Arizona is an outlier in that respect. And a lot of times that money gets sucked up into matching federal dollars and all of the ways that they are able to obscure how they're using it from the people of Arizona and their elected officials.
Well, and I should note that that study that was done on the billion by the Common Sense Institute, they noted that the number could be much, much higher. They went through 990s and tried to identify as much of the funding as possible, but in some ways there's just an unlimited amount of money that is slushing through what has become kind of a cottage industry around this. I think the other thing worth noting is I think the reason there is so much concern over this is, yes, because there are some public safety issues associated with this. It's having a big impact on small businesses in the state from a security standpoint. But it really is a humanitarian crisis, and so many of us, all of us, have in some way, I'm sure, been touched by people in our own family or orbit that have had severe mental illness or drug issues and have either fallen into a dire situation like this or are kind of one step away from it. And so we're seeing a huge increase, you know, I think especially with everything that's occurred the last few years between COVID and other issues of people turning towards substance, and it's a huge problem. You all, Cicero recently did some polling in Arizona to find out where the public was on some of these issues, and there's just a huge desire for action of some kind. 83% of Arizona voters support making it easier for courts to direct homeless individuals with severe mental illness or addiction into treatment facilities. Nearly 75% of Arizona voters say they avoid shopping areas, parks, or other public spaces where there are homeless encampments. A majority, 60%, agree that homeless encampments pose a risk to those who work or live nearby, and two-thirds of Arizonans support establishing drug-free zones around homeless service facilities. A majority also agree that taxpayer-funded homeless service providers should be audited, like you're talking about, to determine whether their programs are effective. It's hard to find anything where you could get 83% of people to agree on, you know, that the sky is blue today in Arizona in this political environment. So I find these numbers pretty stunning, that there is a real pumped up desire for action, for something to be done, and that it shouldn't be something that should be partisan. So it's somewhat frustrating that we haven't been able to crack the nut on how to bring folks together around some of these solutions you're talking about. Are there places in the country that you're seeing some hope for that kind of action?
Absolutely. And, you know, we did some national polling as well, and one of the things we were shocked by is you know, the crux of the Housing First program is that people get a housing subsidy without requirements for sobriety or treatment, and that people who want to choose to live on the street can choose to live on the street until they voluntarily choose to leave the street for a housing voucher. What we found in the national poll was that almost 80% of Democrats who their elected officials have been protecting those policies actually said, no, we should not allow people to camp wherever they want, and we should require sobriety and treatment as a condition of public housing. And I imagine that if we did a follow-up, did a focus group or something, we would have found that they would have been shocked that those things were not already happening. And that's what I think is the disconnect, is that it's almost unbelievable when you start to break down the position that we should be taking vulnerable people, putting them in a housing unit, and then pretending they're just going to magically get better voluntarily. Mm-hmm. It's a ridiculous, you know, premise. And I think the public sees that. They've seen the failure, and it's increasingly hard to hide it. So what I've seen is in Utah, you know, there's not a huge, it's not a Democratic stronghold by any stretch, but
sure,
there are a number of progressive politicians. Mm-hmm. My own state representative introduced a homeless bill of rights this year that would protect some of the camping and all of that. And yet he also voted for a resolution calling on the federal government to remove its housing first mandate, to allow Utah to experiment with other approaches. And in fact, that resolution passed the House unanimously, passed the Senate with only two dissenting votes. So you actually do have Democrats. Even just this morning, a prominent senator and a Democratic senator from Salt Lake gave a speech in favor of some new regulations for harm reduction, some needle exchanges, trying to make sure that those programs are not enabling people. So you're starting to see a tone shift of even Democrats who normally would be sort of protecting this special interest have started to see the failures for themselves. Even they cannot deny it. Even they cannot believe some of the information that they're getting that is just totally the opposite of the day-to-day experience in most American cities.
Yeah, it's truly common sense, a lot of this. So I think it's shocking to people who may, like you said, be more progressive in their politics, but they're not engaged per se, and there's a disconnect between the voter and the politicians. You talked at the beginning about the shift we've seen in recent years around the number of folks who are in a shelter or the percentage of the total population. Do we need more shelter beds? Is this part of that as well? Is there truly just not enough places to house people outside of, setting aside the housing first policy? But, we've seen here in Arizona efforts to house homeless individuals in hotels, in residential areas. That doesn't feel like a great idea. We've seen those kinds of efforts not go well in places like Oregon and California. So is there just a need for more facilities of some kind?
Yeah, I think that there's sort of two parts. And one is that the most shelter funding that's not local comes from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development's Emergency Solutions Grant. So many words. But ultimately, that grant has not increased in value all that much. Mm-hmm. And there is a shortage of shelter beds. Now, Arizona's increased its supply modestly, has not been able to keep pace with the growing homeless population. And that's true in some parts of the country. Now, part of the problem is that Housing First advocates will fight homeless shelters. And they do that because they believe every dime should be spent on housing subsidies. Mm-hmm. Anything that's not paying for housing subsidies, in their view, is not solving homelessness. Mm-hmm. But it leaves people to die on the street until they're able to scrounge up the money for their housing subsidies. So we see that as just cruel. And I think most Americans would as well. We should not let people die on the street. And the reality is congregate shelter is more affordable. You can build a congregate shelter for less money than it would cost to build an individual unit for each of those people. So we need to do more to move people off the street because, frankly, some portion of them will cycle out of homelessness on their own mm-hmm. with quite minimal support. One of the issues with Housing First is that it was designed for the chronically homeless, for the people with the highest acuity. It hasn't worked for that population. Instead, it's primarily worked for people who probably could have gotten out of homelessness on their own. For that high-risk population, the high-need population, they're the ones that might get the voucher and then go wander off back to their encampment. We saw that 10% of San Francisco's homeless population has already received a housing voucher and left. And they don't have that many housing vouchers. It sounds like, oh, it's only 10%. But they're not giving those out willy-nilly. It's a waiting list of years to get one of those. So it's a coveted thing. So the fact that so many of them have already received it and then left is a sign of an issue there. Now, what has happened in Arizona is you've lost about 70% of your transitional housing stock. So it used to be that there was a greater array of housing programs that had more support services. We've seen a gutting of that because Housing First policies directly attack transitional housing. They see it as a bad model. So they've moved all those units that used to have programmatic requirements into the Housing First model, basically to keep the unit, remove the program. So they've doubled the amount of subsidized permanent supportive housing for the homeless in the state of Arizona in the last 10 years. And Again, they cut 70% of the transitional housing. So there's been a marginal increase in some of the facilities, but the type of facility really matters. And emergency shelter and transitional housing have really fallen to the wayside as there's this kind of myopic focus on low barrier, which, you know, refers to not having so many programmatic requirements, not so many standards, rules, et cetera. Low barrier subsidies has been the main focus.
Well, you know, I've actually done quite a bit of work in Oregon, spent a lot of time in Portland. If you want a, if you want to see what things look like when you allow this to spin out of control, just go there. You know, one of the most beautiful cities in the country that has been really just decimated by homelessness, by drug addiction. They legalized all drugs, and shockingly, it attracted a lot of people to the state with a lot of problems. And so now they've had to reverse course on that. So there's still an opportunity for Arizona to get this right, because we're not at that point. You know, for state legislators, for elected officials here in the state who are listening, you know, what would be your advice if you could leave them with one thing as they look at moving forward and doing something productive here? You know, what would you urge of them?
To prepare for change. And I say that because the federal government has been such a force in getting local and state homeless policies to fall in line with Obama and Biden era HUD policy.
Mm-hmm.
That as the administration has changed, we expect that to change substantially. And what I tell every state is you don't want to be caught flat-footed. You want to be proactively thinking about, what do we want our homeless system in Arizona to look like? Let's not listen to California. It doesn't get much worse than that. Let's not look to Oregon. Let's look at what lawmakers have been talking about here. Let's look at what lawmakers have been talking about in states you might want to emulate. You know, Florida's gotten a really good grip on this. They still have a lot of issues, but they're thinking about it very proactively. And I think that Arizona could follow a similar model and look at, you know, what are the needs of this population? What is our capacity currently? And start to prepare for if there was a shift in federal priority and state lawmakers were able to have more access to the funds that were coming into the state to marshal them in the same direction as they're trying to go. Like, that's what we want to see states doing. Mm-hmm. We don't want D.C. and Sacramento to be driving the rest of the country's homeless policy, because it's not the same.
Right.
And you have different you know, orders of magnitude, but you also just have different people, a different environment, and different values. So I think this, as hard as this issue is, especially in Arizona right now, where you have a divided government, I do think that this sort of you know, threshing that's going on over the issue of figuring out where lawmakers stand, what they believe, what they want the system to look like, even if things don't move in the, you know, into law this year, that work is going to be really important in the coming months as they get more and more authority, you know, fingers crossed, over the way that their communities are responding.
Well, I think it's great advice. I think that something has to be done. Like we said, it is a humanitarian crisis. If it's not addressed, it's going to get worse. And frankly, it is there for the taking for someone to show leadership on this. And it's kind of shocking that from a statewide perspective, we haven't seen anyone of either party just, you know, take this issue and own it and provide solutions. And I think that that it's there, it needs to be addressed, and hopefully in 2026 it is more part of the dialogue in our races here, whether it's governor or attorney general, because it needs to be. The voters, clearly based on the polling that you all have done and other data out there, people want something done. The data also shows that it's for good reason. Devin, thank you for coming in. Thanks for sharing all this with you. And we're going to stay on this issue because it's an important one, and look forward to talking more about this as solutions unfold.
Thank you so much for having me.
No problem. I'm living my best life.